From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Hundreds of students have been arrested following pro-Palestinian protests at college campuses across the country. The demonstrations and encampments are in support of the people of Gaza and come with demands that universities divest from companies that do business with Israel. The national movement is Students for Justice in Palestine, which says it's supporting over 350 solidarity organizations across the U.S., including USC, UC campuses, and Cal State universities. This week at Sacramento State, a couple dozen students and community members created an encampment at the Library Quad. Yesterday afternoon, Cap Radio News fellow Tony Rodriguez spoke with Sac State freshman Trent Newman, who was participating in the pro-Palestinian protest.
When it comes to the students, the reaction to this protest has been positive so far. I will say, like, we are more like Democrat-centered campus, but you know, there are students that disagree. I could say that there are certain groups of students on campus that are more right-leaning and more, you know, pro-Israel, very much, you know, differing opinion. But I mean, I think the big thing is, you know, freedom of speech in the first place. I think, you know, even if you disagree, like, you disagree, but I think it's good to disagree. I always think it's good to challenge opinions. But you know, as someone who believes in this, you know, this protest, I stand on my opinions, but I respect everyone's opinion. But so far, everything's been really positive. We're going strong, and I hope to continue more.
In a statement, Sacramento State said that it's committed to maintaining a safe space for those exercising their right to free speech. However, Sac State also gave a protest deadline of midnight tomorrow, May 1st. Trevor Souza is a fourth-year Sac State student, and he is demonstrating with the organization Students for Justice in Palestine.
It is sad to say, because it's sort of a way of telling people that, yes, you have the right to speak, you have your free speech, but only when I allow it. You know, only when you are granted on my time, you are able to be here. When we came out here today, we didn't commit to only just Wednesday. So our response, we are nonviolent. We are still going to commit to being nonviolent and using just our voice here. And we're hoping to outlive Wednesday.
Sacramento State added that if the campus demonstration remains past that May 1st deadline, the university will reassess its response. Up north, however, pro-Palestinian protests at Cal Poly Humboldt escalated over the past week. The university says 25 people were arrested earlier this morning after protesters occupied two campus buildings and defied orders to disperse last Friday. Cal Poly Humboldt put a hard closure to campus over the weekend, and that extends through May 10th, which is the end of the semester. We're going to hear from multiple voices for this conversation up at Cal Poly Humboldt. First, we want to welcome Kiana Zanika, the station manager for KRFH, that is the student-run radio station at Cal Poly Humboldt. Kiana is also supposed to graduate next week. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. I know how busy and intense it has been for you and your fellow student journalists at Cal Poly Humboldt. Can we just start with what happened overnight? You were there in the early morning hours as a student journalist. You were out reporting on the campus and also the response by the university to the encampment at two of those buildings. What did you witness?
So once we got onto campus, and I'm thinking this was closer to 10 because we made a report the day prior, I spoke with a direct source who was the owner of a transportation company, basically got the order to transport the cops. So he spoke to me personally. So I did report that there were plans of cops making moves on Monday night. So me and all my reporters, we got there at 10 o'clock. And yeah, just like a few minutes after our team stepped onto campus, we started hearing the alerts from the campus police car on the loudspeaker, basically telling students that they had 15 minutes to evacuate, that they declare this an unlawful assembly. And then they did say that anyone still in the area could be subject to arrest and that there may be use of kinetic projectiles and chemical agents. This is when a lot of students started putting on their helmets, their goggles, but They did show that they were not going to leave anytime soon. And that same car just circled around campus, basically going to basically making a circle around the quad. But even though they kept on saying 15 minutes, that cycle went on for hours. So that first alert was probably said maybe closer to 10, like we assumed it would be. But the cops did not show up until 2:45 in the morning. And so, you know, you just see people kind of leaving for the night one by one in groups, you know, people thinking that nothing's going to happen, but then seeing kind of like unrest in people. Like I spoke to a few of the student protesters. Some of them still seemed in good spirits. Some of them were definitely very anxious. Our team, we were just circling around the campus, seeing what we could find. We kept getting different reports of different cop sightings. And at a certain point, you know, our radio kind of was on police watch. You know, we were trying to see, like, we're getting all these reports and all this information about school buses being used and stuff, but we could not find the cops. And when we did find them around campus, they were in very small groups. So when they finally did come out at 2:45, it was really shocking. There was a massive group of them, and it was just like a wave, and they seemed to come from Founders Hall right there in the quad. And that's when students started like coming down and putting down the barricades, I guess, just to make a safe exit for those who did want to go to the library circle.
Yeah, and thank you for explaining all of that, because a lot of the reporting that's coming out is coming out from student journalists like you at Cal Poly Humboldt. Humboldt is a beautiful area, but it is very remote. What were the challenges to reporting on this on campus with you and your fellow student journalists?
So some of the challenges was, one, we have a very, very small team. And within my team, I'm like the only actual journalism major. My team involved history majors, art majors, theater majors. We did have a KRFH news team technically, but it was never to this extent. And again, a lot of the people on my team never had a training in reporting journalism. So I had to hold meetings about, you know, just basic media trainings, best journalism practices, ethics. And what I really needed help with was the fact that I was in the booth and I was operating everything, getting all these reports. And I just really needed people out in the field to tell me what was going on. So that was definitely a barrier there, too.
There was also a benefit in that you were also able to work with the paper, the Lumberjack. Could you tell us about the journalism department at Cal Poly Humboldt?
I think the journalism department is amazing. I've been in both newspapers, the Lumberjack and El Leñador. El Leñador is the bilingual newspaper, and then the Lumberjack is like a weekly newspaper. I've been in both, and in both papers, the teams are amazing. I think the journalism department at Cal Poly Humboldt really goes over and out, and I'm surprised that the journalism department at Cal Poly Humboldt isn't talked about more. Like, even last year, we went to a journalism conference and we won a lot of awards, a lot of first place awards. I think we just do amazing reporting, and it's just always talked about within the journalism department and even outside of journalism, with my friends, just talking about the amazing work that's being done by student journalists. And we really commit ourselves. We treat this not necessarily like a job, but yes, like a job, but it really is our passion. Like, we spend hours and hours, like we spend maybe possibly more than we have to necessarily pass the class, because to us, it's not just a class. Like, I myself have like dedicated more time to the publication, sometimes even like getting in the way of like paid work. And I know I'm not alone in this, too.
Yeah. Has the university responded to you and other journalists as you're doing your reporting over the past week or so?
I haven't gotten anything from the university, but from faculty members, like from my teachers, I've gotten so much support. Like, they are so, so grateful for all the work that we're doing. They've been checking up on us. I know my teachers have been checking up on me, asking me if there's anything I need, let me know how I can support you. They've just been so supportive, actually. The entire community has been so supportive.
Given also you're a senior on campus, you're planning to graduate next week. Were you surprised that these demonstrations, which began last week, I believe last Monday at Cal Poly Humboldt, that it escalated in this way?
Yeah, I am. Again, I got notice of something happening that Monday, like earlier that morning, maybe even closer to 11 in the morning. I did have someone tell me that a protest would be happening around 4 p.m. But I didn't think it would get to this point. You know, there's been so many protests and demonstrations at Cal Poly Humboldt, and it's Humboldt. You know, there's just a lot of activism here. There's a lot of people who care about their communities and they act upon it. But I didn't think it would get to this point. I didn't think that my last few weeks of senior year would be essentially canceled. I know we still have classes on Zoom, but it feels kind of, it feels like the semester just got cut short. But, you know, and I know a lot of students feel this way, too. It does make me think of 4 years ago when I graduated from my community college. Like, I had to do a drive-through graduation ceremony because of COVID. And so the feeling of not being able to walk at graduation is not a new feeling for me. So it's okay.
Yeah, because you were supposed to have a commencement ceremony the weekend of May 10th, right?
Yeah, and I haven't heard any word about the actual commencement taking place on May 11th, but I was going to be a part of the Latina graduation ceremony on May 10th. I think they were trying to look for a new location to still make it happen, but I still don't know necessarily what's happening with that.
I also am curious, before we let you go, Kiana, this obviously has received a lot of coverage, as at other campuses, hundreds of campuses across the country. When you were on campus doing this reporting, were there counter protests on campus as well, or just students or the campus community, some people who overall disapproved of what was taking place?
There was just one report of a counter protest. I missed the main peak of it, I think. I just walked in, I saw that a group of people were talking to just one person, and then I was caught up on what happened. You know, he was coming in, blasting country music and saying things to the protesters, and they were saying it was intended to agitate them. But it was reported that some of them were willing to fight him physically, but a larger amount of protesters like stopped it, said, no, that's not what we're here for. That's not what we're about. And so a small group of them took him to the side and they started interviewing him and trying to have a conversation with him. Mm. And that's the only report I got of that.
Well, Kiana, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Kiana Zanica is the station manager for KRFH. That is the student-run radio station at Cal Poly Humboldt. And Kiana is a senior and is supposed to graduate next week. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about pro-Palestinian protests at Cal Poly Humboldt. We just heard from a senior and student journalist. I now want to bring in Sage Alexander. He is a reporter with the Times Standard in Eureka. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Sage, you were on campus this morning after those overnight arrests. What was the scene like? What did it look like?
Yeah, so there's kind of been a hard closure of the campus for a few days now, but this one seemed like an actual hard closure. There were police posted at every car entrance to campus, and they were refusing the entry of faculty, students, and journalists. We have a freelancer that was there earlier this morning who said that he saw that the barricades had been removed that were constructed over the last week, and a lot of the tents were now gone. At one point, there was dozens of tents, and now many of them have been dismantled. Mm. So it seems like,
Well, the University, Cal Poly Humboldt, they released a press release early this morning announcing those arrests and also saying that order has been restored. So I guess, is that a fair thing for the university to say?
Yeah. Something that has really struck me over the past week, just going out there and speaking to the protesters, has been everyone's emphasized to me that the protest has aimed to be nonviolent. I mean, yesterday morning, there were people doing yoga and playing music and blowing bubbles and stuff. A lot of the daytime activity, at least, has been pretty, I don't know if it was disorder, but it was a lot of community building type of events and feeding people. And so I suppose I think that they they removed the people that were hanging out in the quad, but I don't know if order's been been returned.
You know, finally, Eureka is 15 minutes from campus. You obviously write for the local paper. How much interest is this getting from the community outside of Cal Poly Humboldt?
I would say that people are very interested in it. In Humboldt, whenever there's like a protest more than like 20 people, it's usually worth covering. And the events have drawn like hundreds of people. And I would also say that people are very interested in terms of like the news coverage of it. There's a long history at in Arcata and in Humboldt in general about anti-war protests. So I think there's some historical threads going on there.
Have you had access to university leadership? We reached out to Cal Poly Humboldt. They declined to come on the show, but they referred us, you know, to the link that they have on their campus website with campus updates.
There's been some university administrators that we were able to interview kind of that were on campus. We were granted access, or my coworker was able to do an interview with the president after kind of radio silence from him and a lot of the administrators throughout this protest. So we've had pretty limited communications with the university other than through news releases sent out. And that's standard for that university throughout the year that I've worked here.
Sage, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Sage Alexander is a reporter with the Times Standard in Eureka, sharing his reporting about the pro-Palestinian demonstrations at Cal Poly Humboldt, which have resulted, according to the university, in 25 arrests as of this morning. We did invite Cal Poly Humboldt to join us, and they declined. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're now going to broaden this conversation with Keith David Wattenpaugh, a professor of human rights studies at UC Davis. Welcome back.
Thank you, Vicky. It's great to be here.
So my first question is, how are things developing on the UC Davis campus?
Well, UC Davis, things are relatively quiet. Our students have engaged in protests over the past weeks. I know there's a very active Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. And I imagine that over the next few days that they, too, will begin to enter into this, what I see as really a critical generational shift in attitudes on American campuses. It's not just a reflection of what the students perceive as hypocrisy and cruel indifference to the suffering of Palestinians and American complicity in Israel's war on them, but also, you know, just discontent with the world that they are inheriting in terms of climate justice, wealth inequality, and, you know, criminal justice, justice reform.
Why do you think some demonstrations and encampments have grown to the size that they've grown to, while at other universities and other campuses it hasn't happened?
Well, every university, every campus is different. They have their own culture. I think that in the case of the University of California system, where there's been large encampments at UCLA and smaller encampments elsewhere, our sort of ingrained respect for freedom of speech, which is part of our responsibility to public university, has had an effect that welcomes the right of protest, but not necessarily agrees with the intent or the sentiments of the protesters. There was some throwing of fists at the UCLA demonstration over the weekend. But again, you know, what we want to see people expressing themselves and using this space to test ideas. It also has to do with the different leadership styles of the campuses. I think at UC Davis, we have a particular experience with encampments and an overreaction by a chancellor. And I'm referencing the early 10 years ago, the pepper spray incident, where our chancellor at the time, Linda Cadet, vastly overreacted to a very small and simple encampment and led to violence against peaceful protesters. I think Gary May has done a wonderful job embracing the two principles of empathy and consistency in addressing and acknowledging protesters' concerns, but also making sure that the campus is still a warm and inviting and safe place to learn in the classroom. But I also see the right to protest and express yourself as part of learning and becoming a citizen.
Yeah, and the right to protest can be counter-protests as well.
Absolutely.
Also concerns about anti-Semitism and just overall people who disapprove of destruction of property, which has taken place at some of these demonstrations. Mm-hmm. What stands out to you about striking that right balance of free speech and safety of everyone on campus?
Of course. One of the big issues that we have to think about in this moment is what I call the weaponization of anti-Semitism, the accusation of it. Anti-Semitism is odious. It's serious. If the accusations are raised, they should be dealt with seriously. But, you know, opposing the policies of the State of Israel or calling out for a ceasefire or objecting to United States support, military support for Israel, or decrying the violations of international humanitarian law, these aren't anti-Semitic. And I'm also worried that what's being lost in accusations that many of these demonstrations are anti-Semitic, and you'll always attract extremists to these as well, is that it denies the agency of American Jewish students in standing up for what they believe in, perhaps in opposing, but also the fact that there are many Jewish students in the encampments who are expressing their concerns about the suffering of Palestinians and their desire for peace.
This is, saying it's complicated is doesn't even do it justice. But and I think it's a difficult story to cover with that nuance and also that history. I mean, this stems from October 7th. There are still Israeli hostages following those deadly attacks by Hamas. You also have over 30,000 people killed in Gaza in that response. And at the center of this are all innocent human lives. How do you want people to think about this as it continues to develop and in some cases escalate?
So over the last week, there have been two international and domestic but also international developments in the international human rights and humanitarian law world. One is the thought that the International Criminal Court and lead prosecutor Karim Khan will be issuing arrest warrants for violations of international human rights law, calling for the arrest of leaders of Hamas who orchestrated the horrible attack on the citizens of Israel on October 7th. Not only a violation of the basic rules of war, but also a crime against humanity. And then also arrest warrants that will be directed against the leadership of the State of Israel, including Benjamin Netanyahu, for adopting a strategy of starvation towards the people of Gaza. And that's we don't permit siege warfare against civilians anymore. It's a clear violation of international humanitarian law. And I think what's important here is that the International Criminal Court is signaling a different direction, which is that terrible violations of human rights and terrible war crimes do not justify war crimes being committed by the other side. And indeed, justice and holding people accountable for their actions, making this act of accountability something that's alive in people's expectations is one of the ways that we can try to achieve peace. And the United States, we're also dealing with the reality that our own State Department now, U.S. Agency for International Development and others, lawyers within those institutions have begun to conclude that Israel's blockage or interference with humanitarian assistance, including humanitarian assistance coming from the United States, violates American law. And so the United States must cease supplying military assistance to Israel. So what I'd ask people to think about here is that what is our priority? Our priority here should be saving lives, achieving justice, and also making sure that we are listening to other voices within our society who are witnessing the kind of the hypocrisy and the impunity that seems to be driving American foreign policy at the moment.
Mm. Professor Wattenpaul, as always, thank you. Keith David Wattenpaul is a professor of human rights studies at UC Davis, and we've been discussing the pro-Palestinian protests that are taking place at college campuses across the country. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.